Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fratello Talks. I'm your host, Nacho, and this week I'm joined by my colleagues...
Morgan.
And RJ.
Yes, welcome to the show, guys. This week, we're going to be discussing some of the most important watches of the past 5 years. But before we do that, let's see what's on the wrist. Morgan, let's start with you.
Okay, so today...
It's, look at that smile.
Yeah, it's new from... I think I got it 2 days ago. It's my brand new from 2006 Omega Seamaster 300M reference 2531.80.
Yes. Something new, something blue. Very nice.
Yeah, super nice. Love it.
Lovely.
Very cool.
Very nice. It's no 2254, but you know.
Yeah, listen.
It's pretty good.
Listen.
Excellent. And what have you got on your wrist, RJ?
I'm wearing my Speedmaster in Moonshine Gold from 2019.
Very, very nice. Lovely. Great watch.
How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm wearing a Breitling Aerospace.
Oh.
From the early 2000s. Not sure the exact reference, but yeah, it's my little minute repeater.
Yes.
Very fancy.
Yeah. Nice.
In titanium. Yeah, perfect. So let's get right into the topic. We decided to have a little bit of a look back. It's still early days of 2024. So we thought let's take a look back at the past 5 years and try to find some of the most important, relevant, interesting, and
significant
watches, yes, of the past 5 years. We had quite a bit of a powwow to get to the bottom of it. But I think that we've got a pretty good list. So we've each selected three.
Yeah.
So we're gonna take turns and go through our list, yeah, and have a bit of a discussion there.
Let me add to that yes, it wasn't easy,
no,
because we looked back at the last 5 years to see what has been released and what was really significant or causing some turmoil and so on. There has not been that much. We did a few selections ourselves. We each picked three, but it was not easy, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was certainly easier to focus on the watches we thought were great,
yeah,
or watches that were interesting for a specific brand. But it's true that within the wider context over the past 5 years, for watches as a whole, for the watch industry, to find those that were truly impactful and truly important, it was tricky. But I think we narrowed it down and have some good ones.
Yeah, I agree. So,
okay, let's start with you, Morgan. What's your first pick as significant watches of the past 5 years?
I'm going to pick one randomly. There's no specific order to it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with the Tudor FXD.
Okay.
So for me, this one is a significant watch. I bought it myself, so I also like it.
That makes it significant on its own.
Endorsed by Morgan.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly. No, but the thing, I think it's an insanely good watch in a way that this is a new design, mm-hmm, that they brought. I mean, you still have the connection with the Marine National. I mean, we're talking about the blue one because then there really is a few more, but let's talk about the first one, which went...
But in the end, it's a Pelagos, right?
Yeah.
It's a Pelagos. Yeah, but then they took some decisions like to reduce the water, mm-hmm, resist, to remove the helium escape
and
valve.
Fixed bars.
Yeah. So it's a little bit thinner and fixed bar. And I think it's a really important watch because nowadays you don't see a lot of new design in watches. Usually they take back some designs already existing, they tweak it a little bit. And I think this one is really awesome because it's a pretty new design, never saw before. And of course it takes root with the first Tudor Submariners, with the fixed bar that there was, these watches were assigned to the militaries and French Marine National. And I think it's a really significant one, actually. It's just cool. It's really sturdy. It's durable. It's precise. And it's, I mean, titanium also. They added, they used kind of an old ID and they did it with new tech.
Yeah.
New design, new movement, new everything.
And keep it relatively affordable, I would say.
Yeah. And still in a good price. Like,
and I think most of our listeners and viewers, I think they would agree with you as well because the demand for these watches was so incredibly high.
Yeah.
And perhaps still is, I don't know. But
It's still the most on-demand watch. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. A good pick.
Yeah. It's a kind of a breakaway from the crutch of Rolex for Tudor, I believe, and sort of modern, because we said obviously the North Flag was really that first
in 2014,
big but that was obviously more than last 5 years. But then taking a sliver of that Rolex DNA and of its mm-hmm, its own sort of back catalog, and then bringing it into this modern, affordable, fully spec'd, fantastic thing. Yeah, it's also very much its own thing.
And Northflag was not that successful, I think. It was discontinued rather quickly. Yeah.
It was almost like too...
They were too early, perhaps.
Yeah. But they brought the in-house movement with this one and open case back and stuff. So it was still something. But that's something I like with Tudor. You kind of never know what they're going to come up with.
Yeah.
And this one you could have never predicted.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like you said, that it's affordable, it really democratizes access to a really good watch. I mean, it's still now around 4K these days, but at first it was three something.
And also for the little story, I know a watchmaker who used to work for Tudor when this watch was engineered and stuff.
Oh, in development, yeah.
In development, and it was really strict. No one could see it, and it was a specific amount of people who had access to a specific room when there was all the design and stuff.
Yeah, you see that more often with watch brands. They try to keep the circle as small as possible, especially when it's like a new groundbreaking
release. It was really like important, and a few person only could have access to the information. Yeah.
What I find interesting is that there's a bit of a side track, but that Tudor is really separated from Rolex, also with their production facilities. Yeah. They're in Le Locle, not in Geneva.
Separated.
I think the only things they share is probably HR department and and some IT infrastructure. But I think it's very much like an independent operating sub-company of the Rolex group.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
That was my first pick.
Wonderful. So I'll go with my first pick, which will actually be, I'm thinking a little bit more tactically. I'm not doing it random. Okay. But I'm going to go with the Moon Swatch.
Oh.
With the Omega X Swatch Moon Swatch. Mm. I think that this was a watch that, as inexpensive and
people love to hate it, man.
Made of bioceramic and all the long list of comments, quartz, not serviceable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that it still had a very measurable impact on watches, on sort of a hype surrounding the world of watches. And I mean, you know, I've never seen something like that day in Rotterdam where it was launched. There was a line with over 1,000 people for, I think, perhaps 25 watches.
Yeah.
It was completely
insane. There were fights. There was some stabbing going on in other countries.
People
it was
flipping
crazy.
Them for insane amounts.
And also, what I like about that watch, even if I don't want to own one or because I own the real one, but a lot of people who love the Moon watch and can't afford it for whatever reason, they can still have a little bit of it.
It tapped into a different kind of community, like the sneaker collecting community.
Yeah, for sure. The hype
beast. It's a bit of a high snobiety or high beast kind of community.
For sure.
They know the Moonwatch because it's an icon, Omega's a household name, and then Swatch makes something available in that design, basically.
At a good price point.
It's a fair price point. And what I also think is that a lot of Speedmaster collectors, and I'm including myself here, I liked the project and I bought a few actually.
Yeah.
Because, man, I really like the watch. I don't wear them that often, but I think it's a
collectible item
to have. It's collectible. We had several people here at the Fratello office that have them all. Mm. And
It's quite impressive.
When
you see them all in one place, it's kind of a cool thing.
And then, I think everyone was impressed because... Yeah. It was released right before Watches and Wonders 2022.
It stole the show.
It stole the show because wherever we went and we were wearing them,
we had
early access, we were wearing them at all the brands, including Patek and so on.
Yeah.
They said, oh, show me the Moonswatch.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
You would take it off to try on.
You heard the Velcro everywhere.
And it would turn heads. It was definitely a phenomenon. Yeah. And I think... Probably the least fitting of my list, but I think it deserves that spot. And it made a hell of a splash.
It changed something in the world of.
I don't think the same could be said for the
the Blancpain.
And I don't think the same could be said for the follow-ups, the Moonshine, Mission to Moonshine, all those sequels.
No, because the surprise effect was gone.
Yeah, it was lightning in a bottle, and I think trying to recreate it. It never was quite going to work out, but hey, I mean, you know, it started this interesting and exciting sort of offshoot.
Fully agree. Good pick.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Nice.
So RJ, what's your first pick?
My first pick would be the watch I'm wearing, actually, because I didn't pick it for that. I didn't pick it for that. But I think in the past 5 years, I think Omega did a tremendous job. Although some people, including myself, are a little bit complaining that they're either not available or there's not that much going on, it seems, in terms of new models. But I think the gold Moonshine Speedmaster was the first to have the new caliber 3861.
Yeah, Meta certified.
Yeah, so it was Master Chronometer certified. So the movement and in the case. So the whole watch was certified, basically. Mm-hmm. And they grabbed back to the fourth generation case of the Moonwatch. They did an nearly exact copy of the 1969 Moonwatch in gold. And they brought back the Nixon bracelet that they also later on revamped in the steel one. So this watch was basically 2 years earlier than the current Moonwatch, but had all the ingredients already except for the material of the case and the bracelet. And I think it's a very faithful re-edition of the original from 69. Mm-hmm. But I think it's like, I think I wrote it in the article. For me, it's a bit like Godfather 2. It's better than the first.
Yeah. Mm.
I think they did a tremendous job on this one. So that's also why I bought it. It was out of my my reach financially, I think, but I had to sell some stuff. Mm. Bought one. I really, really love it. And I wear it so often.
Yeah, you wear it quite a lot.
So it's really one of my favorite release in the past 5 years. And I said it as a Speedmaster collector. Yeah. And of course, I have one, but I think also outside, I think it's a really proper release.
Yeah, like you say, the impact going into the re-release of the Moonwatch or the revamp of the Moonwatch. I think that's really a key point.
And that was in the plan, of course, because they don't don't develop a new move from the 3861 just for this watch. I think after this one, it was also in the steel one, the steel and gold Apollo 11 one. Mm. And of course, they used it for the Silver Snoopy Award 50th anniversary, the little automaton on the case back. And then in 2021, they released it in the Moonwatch.
Yeah, very nice. I think we have to mention also the Spyrate technology introduced last year. I think that was also quite an interesting thing. But somehow this is just feels more significant, a little bit more impactful going down.
And interesting is as well that the Master Chronometer certificate also says something about water resistance and the testing. Mm. So a lot of people complain that the Moonwatch is not really water resistant. But the ones, well, they are in the end, 50 meters. Yeah. You can swim with them. Don't dive, but you can swim. But now with the Master Chronometer certificate, the watch is really tested to 50 meters plus 10%. It is really water resistant.
And you have a little...
I think that's a step forward.
You have a little text about that on the website. When you take a look at the Omega Speedmaster, it now has a little section when it says... You can swim and
That changed. And what's also interesting with the whole Master Chronometer certification, I think that's also something significant from the past few years.
For sure,
it was a bit earlier than
it's quite an undertaking.
2018. But once you buy a watch with that certification, you can go online and see all the test results for your specific watch,
with the number.
Which I think is nice.
It's cool
for sure. Yeah. For sure. Perfect.
And it's perfect for the next one. While we are here, let's go all in. So for me, I would pick the Speedmaster, the professional, the current one, steel, classic, Isolite, whatever. I think it's significant in the way of, for me, the Speedmaster is probably the most iconic watches of them all time.
It's up there. It's in the top.
Top two, top three.
Top three. For me, it would be even top one, but I think it's the most significant watch ever produced. I think it has the most beautiful design of all the watches.
It's got the coolest story.
It has a funky story too. Yeah. Some people will say we never went to the moon, but hey, that's another topic. Yeah,
we don't talk to those people.
Yeah. But I mean, for me, it's such an iconic watch that when you have... to do it again, to reinvent it, to bump it up, to whatever. Better not mess up because then it's really important. I think, I don't know, but it's probably one of their bestseller, I guess.
Yes, the Moonwatch and the Seamaster 300M.
Yeah, exactly.
And I believe what's interesting, you picked the Hasselite one.
Yeah.
What I heard is that the best-selling Speedmaster Professional is the Sapphire one. And it's for the first time, basically, because the previous versions were also available with the Sapphire Crystal.
Yeah.
It's the current one that oversells the Hasselite.
So for me, this one, this watch is really awesome. I mean, there's a little bit of some differences between the Essilite and the and the Sapphire one, the Applied logo and things like that.
It's very clever, the finishing on the bracelet. Yeah, it's clever different stuff.
But I think they really did it well. The proportion are better, in my opinion, a little bit shorter, even if it's not a lot, but still. Yep. The bracelet is really cool. It's the Nixon bracelet, as the one you're wearing, but in steel.
And it has that micro-adjust in the clasp.
Now it has the micro-adjust, so they still even... But the first one didn't have it. The current one, the first place, it was just a new design bracelet, but then they added the new clasp also, which is a good thing. And yeah, Meta certified movement. Stop second when you want to when you're hacking the movement, it really stops, so you can really set it perfectly. Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of things like that I love.
Dot over 90, of course.
Dot over 90, a lot of things like that.
Step dial
as well. Yeah.
And the Chronograph second hand has the old short end.
And the snailing on the sub dial. I know I'm saying that because I don't have it on mine, but yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, true. Yeah, no, a good pick. I would also say, but it's your pick, of course.
Yeah.
What I like for the current Speedmaster, I think I would have picked the Speedmaster Caliber 321 in stainless steel.
That's a good one.
Because, and I agree with you, I think the Speedmaster Professional stainless steel is the best one you can buy, full stop.
Yeah.
But the 321 is interesting because it's one of the few watches that is produced differently than all the other Omegas.
And you have a special line in the manufacturer.
There's a special atelier at the Omega HQ in Biel where they hand assemble the 321 movement, but also the entire watch. So it's done by one watchmaker.
Yeah.
It's double assembly, like a Lange. So they take it apart again, then assemble it again.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like doing haute horlogerie at a brand that is like fully set up to make something in an industrialized way.
And actually they...
It's very outside of their comfort zone.
Yeah.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I think they scanned the first 3-2-1 movement and did it again, especially for this one.
Because they didn't have the original drawings. The license for that movement, of course, it's a Lemania-based movement, but the license for that movement was with Breguet. And they used it, and Patek used it. And but it's a Lemania 2310. And Omega got green light to use it again.
Yeah.
And what they did, they took the Speedmaster 105003 from Gene Cernan, who was wearing it on the moon during Apollo 17.
Yeah.
They took that watch.
That's
and
cool
they did
story.
A tomography, like a scan.
And then they redid all
then
the
they
pieces.
Based on that scan, they recreated usable drawings, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah, cool. Very. Also would have been a worthy pick, so gets a bit of a mention. Up from me, my next pick is the Code 1159 by Audemars Piguet, the Ultra Complication Universelle.
That's amazing.
Complication Universelle, Research and Development 4. So I think that's... I mean, where to even start, right? It's got 23 complications, 40 functions. It was 7 years of development. It's really to me, it's interesting because it shows a real like doubling down on the Code 1159, which was a watch that was not, let's say, warmly received at first, not overly so, at least not by the enthusiast community. And I think that this was the brand really doubling down and pulling off a truly impressive piece of complicated horology and choosing very purposefully to put it in the Code 1159.
Funny thing is that every year AP, they invite journalists. So I went there as well last year to Le Brassu. And then we went to the Manufacture, the new one in, I think it's La Chaux-de-Fonds. Lockler, one of the two. It's a huge building. It looks like you're entering like a Google building, like a Silicon Valley building, super modern. And there they did different presentations throughout the manufacture. Right. And one of the presentations was about this ultra complication watch.
Okay.
And I think they took like 30 or 40 minutes and it was just not done. I mean, they could have gone on for hours, I guess,
to explain all the complications.
Yeah, they just explained a few bits and pieces, and then the time was up. Basically,
you have to you have to kind of grasp in your mind that this is a 42 millimeter watch, same size as a Speedmaster. It's 15.5 millimeters thick, and it has 23 complications. And I mean, we're talking grand sonnery, minute repeater, perpetual calendar. It has a split second flyback chronograph and a flying tourbillon, and that's not even close to being 23 of them, right?
The list goes on and on. 15.2 millimeter thick, yeah. It's not 15.5. a lot.
Yeah, it's
when you think about that.
It's crazy. The Zodiac Seacron was 17 millimeters thick. It's a chronograph.
To bully the Zodiac watch as well.
There it also shows that if you want to create watches like this that are still wearable, because it is wearable.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so much more expensive to get it done in a proper way to make it wearable.
They probably have to engineer every component. So even if you want to have it marginally thinner,
sometimes we complain about watches being too thick, but I think every millimeter off, I think the cost is just not justified. The price would be so much higher for that watch. And this is what 1.6 million Swiss francs or something?
1.6 million Swiss francs. I would recommend that all of our listeners and viewers check out the introduction article that Jörg put together. I'll link it in the show notes. But it's a truly impressive thing, and it's really like to have that also in a very modern looking watch, mm-hmm. because it's truly a modern looking case. It's a very contemporary looking thing, and it's just really, really impressive.
Yeah.
And it's also in that line, the Cod 1159 is also a pretty new line within the Audemars Piguet catalog, actually.
Yeah, it's a bold move. They could have also done it in a Royal Oak. They have in the past with the research and development too. But I think that doing it in this, in the Cod 1159, it's really, it's a fantastic watch.
Yeah.
Really, really cool.
Fully agree.
RJ, what's your second pick?
It's not as expensive as the Audemars Piguet. But it has more or less the same shape as a Royal Oak.
Okay,
it's the Tissot PRX.
Yeah,
Hauteurology at its finest.
Yeah, exactly. It's a mass-produced watch.
Yeah,
we're talking about Tissot, so they produce around 3 million watches a year, more or less.
Wow.
And with this watch, I think it was an important release.
Yeah, of course.
Because absolutely. It was I think introduction price was 700 something euros for the automatic one.
I think they started with the quartz one.
Yeah. Quartz was a bit cheaper and an automatic one is 700 something. But it got so many people into watches.
Yeah.
And also people who were already into watches and also collect more expensive pieces bought a PRX. A lot of places that I visit, I see people wearing a PRX, and they're not specifically watch people. They just want to have a nice watch, and they bought that PRX.
Yep.
And I think we need more of those watches that get people into this hobby or passion of ours. And I think the PRX did an amazing job.
I think the Moonwatch is kind of do the same in
Moon's
a way.
Watch, yeah,
the Moonwatch, yeah.
Yeah, but I will not say it's a gimmicky thing. But there's a bit of a fashion component or a swatch component.
Yeah.
And it's quartz. And of course, the first PRX is also quartz. But with this automatic, I think you buy into horlogerie.
There has to be a bit of thoughtfulness, PRX, right?
It's automatic.
Yeah.
They've extended the collection because it started with blue dial, I think, only maybe black and blue.
Blue and black, maybe.
Blue and black. And then there's like
and silver,
white.
Silver.
You have the rose gold, green.
You have the Tiffany color.
Tiffany blue.
And now they have the
chrono. You have a lot of things. Different sizes also.
Yeah.
Gold PVD coated ones. You can really find the one for you.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think it's an amazing watch. I have the chronograph. I have to be honest. I don't wear it that much. But I think in hindsight, I rather would have gotten the normal one.
Okay.
But yeah, I think it's an impressive release from Tissot. Nobody saw it coming.
For sure.
And it puts Tissot back on the map, I think. Because I think one of their best sellers also was that T-Touch.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people know that T-Touch. They were into hiking and so on. Yeah. And with the PRX, I think, man, everyone knows the PRX. Everyone knows Tissot again.
For sure. Really it used good. To be these PRS
chronographs and so on.
With the yellow accents.
Yeah.
I remember seeing those and thinking they were extremely cool
way
back in the day. But I think, the PRX, it's really cool because it's also a vintage callback. It's a callback to a watch from the 70s, but at the same time turned into something that it's completely its own thing. And it gives you a lot for the price for 775, I think it is these days. It's a hell of a watch.
Yeah,
really cool.
Mighty
Powermatic.
DT, that's really nice.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Cool. So Morgan, your third and final pick.
So my third and final pick would be more than one watch would more be a collection, let's say, or at least two watches.
Okay.
For me, it would be the new...
That's cheating, but I'll allow it.
Okay. It would be the Daytona, the new one. Not especially for the new bezel insert and new redesigned dial and everything. But I would more thinking about the Platinum one because it has an open case back.
Okay.
It has an open case back. So yeah, new things like that. From Rolex, it's not in the same level as for the other brands because we know that Rolex goes on, but really small bit by small bit. It's just really...
They move at their own pace and that's it.
And so they went, so the first pick is the Platinum one with an open case back. It's the first Daytona with an open case back from the brand because Artisan de Genève did it already, but they redesign it kind of, you know. So the first one really from the brand with an open case back is the Daytona within the sport collection because you also have the 1908 with an open case back, but it's more classic one. Mm-hmm. So I think for Rolex,
and they changed the rotor for the open case back version because in the past you could buy a spare case back, see through case back.
Oh, aftermarket.
Yeah, aftermarket. Yeah. I think Thomas Prake or something, they made these case backs. And at some point I thought, oh, perhaps I'll get one for my sea dweller or whatsoever.
Yeah. But it was not from Rolex, right?
No. Yeah. So aftermarket. But so it's an ugly rotor to look at.
Yeah, the movement is not really... No, it's fantastic.
The movement is nice. It has perlage and it looks okay with the red wheels. But the rotor is awful, industrial looking.
Yeah.
But that they changed for this occasion for the Platinum Daytona.
It's
gold. Different.
It's 18 karat.
22
gold,
maybe. 22 karat, maybe. 18 karat.
Yeah, it's gold.
Yeah. Yeah, it's gold. Yeah, it's gold. It's gold. So that would be the first one. And also later on during the year, because it came out this year too, it's the limited edition Le Mans. The Daytona limited edition
with
Le Mans.
A 24-hour recorder.
Yeah, exactly. So cool. This one, they did it. So they brought back the Paul Newman dial with a little white sub dial and a little. Square markers on it, if you're not familiar with it. And they also developed the movement especially for this one, only for that watch, because there's, like you said, RJ, a 24-hour register for the chronograph instead of a 12-hour in the normal one. So I think this one...
It's very uncommon for Rolex to do these kind of things.
They were listening to enthusiasts and they brought back something that enthusiast people wanted. Of course, it's a 50 something K watch and it's limited and it's probably the hardest model to get from the catalog over all the other ones. It's white gold also. There's a little on the ceramic bezel insert, you have a hundred in red. And but the special movement for it, it's like they revived the Paul Newman Daytona. Mm-hmm. And this is not a move that you can do. You'll see a lot from Rolex.
When Rolex does something that you don't expect, the world pays attention. I mean, the watch world definitely takes note, pays attention.
But they always do stuff that nobody's expecting.
Well, for sure.
Aside from some leaks in the past, I think the Yachtmaster was in titanium, was a bit leaked
it was
up front.
Worn by,
But they often come with stuff that nobody expects Nobody is waiting for it, basically, but everyone wants it.
Yeah, I mean, the Daytona, the Paul Newman, it's impressive. For you to know the Paul Newman Daytona for the listeners and the viewers, these are the one who goes for the most. Yeah. These are the one, I mean, when you sell them, what is the name already? At auction, when you sell a watch at auction, a Rolex Paul Newman Daytona, these
it's
are the one
the
who goes,
breaking,
it's groundbreaking ones. Yeah. So yeah, I think it was something from the brand.
Mm-hmm. For sure, mine, I won't spend a lot of time on this one because it's already come up a couple of times in our roundup, I believe, for last year's the best watches of 2023. But it's the Blancpain 50 Fathoms Tech Gambessa. And
you like that one, eh?
I like it. I need to see it in person someday because it's really, I really want to get my hands on it. But it's, I think that just, it's reinventing the wheel. It's taking the dive watch, something which we all say, well, it's no longer really relevant as a tool for modern divers. And you know, that's true. You can wear one, but obviously you're going to typically have a backup in your dive computer. But this one really takes it takes the experience of current divers, current professional divers, Laurent Ballesta, and it looks at his needs in a dive watch, and then that's you know the sort of the pillar upon which it was developed. And of course now it has a special movement which tracks 3 hours of elapsed time, which for current rebreather divers mm-hmm. is what makes sense. So I think that it's just cool to have taken the dive watch as we know it, as we've known it since the late 50s, and turned it into something for those who are still doing this today. So I think that's nice. Really really cool. Yeah, for sure.
Good pick.
Yeah,
unexpected. And,
yeah, a little bit, but for me it was a clear one. I have to say for looking at the last 5 years, it's yeah, and also that it's a 50 fathoms hitting on the 70th anniversary as well. I think that's it was very 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 cool.
Yeah,
nice. Cool. What's your third and final pick?
It's a watch that is discontinued, and it's also the last one as such. It was the 2021 Patek Philippe Nautilus 5711 with a Tiffany dial.
Okay.
And
in steel, though, yeah.
Yeah, of course, in steel. And earlier that year, they had the dark green one, and that should have been the last, but then they decided, no, this is going to be the last. So they did one with a Tiffany dial. It was a limited piece, I think, of 170 watches, I believe. It had a retail price of nearly $60,000.
Right.
And there are a few for sale on Chrono 24, all above 2 million. So it's quite something. And I think it's also where the whole Tiffany hype took off.
Yeah,
definitely.
Rolex, of course, did the OP with the Tiffany dial. I think it's the collectors and enthusiasts that call it the Tiffany dial. But of course, Rolex just want to have a green dial. But also the Tissot PRX that we just mentioned is available in that color.
Yeah.
And I think I was just baffled when they did that, because of course there are more Patek Philippe Tiffany signed dials. Mm. But to end the Nautilus in stainless steel, the 5711 with a Tiffany dial, I think that's quite something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it cost quite a stir. It also cost quite a stir when it went to auction for the first time. I think the amounts were crazy.
Yeah, it was millions.
And it's also a bit of a pity that the 5711 in stainless steel has been discontinued. I know there's a new version in white gold introduced last year, I think, but... Yeah. That watch also needs to be there in stainless steel. That's how Genta and Patek together had envisioned it.
Yeah.
I feel it's a pity that it's gone. But I can also imagine that it was a bit of a burden for Patek Philippe, because that was the Patek Philippe that everyone wanted. Yeah. Yeah. And there was no demand, I will not say, but the other watches got less attention. Than they deserve attention.
They didn't want to be a one watch brand.
Exactly.
It makes sense. And I don't think it'll be very long until we see it make a comeback.
I hope so.
I think maybe a few years, let the hype die down even a little bit more. But I think that it's inevitable that watch will return.
Because AP did the opposite. AP revamped their Royal Oak Jumbo. The 15202 got replaced by the 16202. Mm-hmm. They put a new movement inside. It finally has a quick set date, but they kept all the proportions of the watch, the 39 millimeter case, the thin bracelet. Everything was kept in that nice kind of Genta design.
Yeah.
And Patek did the opposite. They just killed it.
Yeah, but I think that Patek has way more collection in their catalog than AP. Because AP for me also AP everybody kind of wants the Royal Oak
of course it's like a Jaeger LeCoultre. I mean it's all reverso, and of course they have the code 1159 at AP, but for me that's not per definition a bad thing that the Royal Oak is almost as big as a brand as such.
They leaned into it,
but I don't see exactly the same thing.
But Patek is a different company.
Patek is different still, and
I think they became an AP with their Nautilus because everyone wanted that. And I think it's very clear that Patek also wanted to be Patek and have different models than their Nautilus. Yeah, that's my third and last pick.
Cool. I think that that's a nice lineup of nine picks there. Obviously, there's been some honorable mentions along the way.
Yep.
And now we give one of our faithful listeners an honorable mention themselves with our viewer comment of the week. So this week, it comes from Gair Booze, who says, "This episode was a lot of fun. What do you think will happen to the microbrand market in 2024?
Ooh.
And we're not going to comment on that just yet, but perhaps it'll be an idea for an episode in the future.
Yes.
But yeah, for now, let us know your thoughts in the comments down below. Remember to like, subscribe, and of course, as always, tune in next week for another episode of Fratello Talks. See you then.